Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Before we begin, a few housekeeping notes. I'm going to be taking a two-week sabbatical from the show from July 10th to the 23rd, but I will return on the 24th with an interesting conversation about interesting rituals in India. I hope that you will be around for that. In the meantime, during those 2 weeks that I'm gone, we will be hosting a couple encore presentations, some shows from the archives that you may have forgotten or never heard in the first place. So continue listening and please tell a friend, and I will see you again on July 24th as we are approaching our 300th episode, which is very exciting here. Okay. Our guest today is Mark David Hall, our standard go-to guy for all things 4th of July and historical. Today's conversation marks the fifth time in our 6 years that Mark has appeared as a guest, and has always been a pleasure to have him on since I, and hopefully you, learn a great deal from him. Dr. Hall is the Herbert Hoover Distinguished Professor of Politics at George Fox University in Newburgh, Oregon, where he is also a faculty fellow in the William Penn Honors Program. Additionally, he has been a total dude, meaning a senior research fellow at Baylor's ISI since 2011, and ISR is the fine sponsor of our show. Professor Hall is an expert on religion during the U.S. Revolutionary era, but has written broadly on the role of religion in politics and church and state in American society. He is author and editor of numerous books, including Faith and the Founders of the American Republic, Roger Sherman and the Creation of the American Republic, America's Forgotten Founders, and several other books that we will link to on our website. He recently penned an article for The Backgrounder, a publication of the Heritage Foundation, entitled Religious Accommodations and the Common Good, which we will also link to at www.researchonreligion.org. It is that article on religious accommodations and the common good that will be the topic of our discussion today. And don't forget, over at our website, you will also find Mark's other interviews, including his intriguing answer to the question, should Christians have fought in the U.S. War of Independence? We had a debate a few years ago amongst three scholars, one who said, yes, fight on, a second who said, no way should Christians have gotten involved, and then a firm position in the squishy middle that revolved around, maybe yes, maybe no. To find out which side Dr. Hall saddled up to, head over to our website. Mark, welcome once again to Research on Religion, and happy 4th of July.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's great to be back.
Yeah, that's 4th of July is when I love having you, because that has been a holiday that has been a fountain of research questions for you for a long time, and you've written so much, so it's got to be one of your favorite holidays too, huh?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I was just looking back at our archives from last year and trying to set up a few encore presentations that we will have in the next 2 weeks, as I mentioned earlier. And I realized that we did not have a patriotic theme podcast last year featuring you. And then I started thinking to myself, you know, self, that must be because we pretty much said all that there is to say about religion in the U.S. during the late 18th and early 19th century. I mean, that's it. You said it all. Done.
Well, I'd sure like to think so. If only I could get some justices and other scholars to agree with me, the debate would be over.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, what fun would that be? You would have less to write then, you know?
No, absolutely right. I think, you know, the questions are almost innumerable. The American founding, properly understood, involves literally hundreds of people, men and women, from the most famous to important but not quite as famous. And I think the debates will always have an importance. Scholars can argue about anything under the sun, of course. But these debates have policy implications for today, right? They involve church-state issues, religious liberty issues, everyone wants the founders on their side. So I think these debates are not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, and that is what we want to talk about today. Normally we have you talking about something that happened in the 1700s or maybe the early 1800s, but today we're going to talk about some issues that are more contemporary but yet have very historical roots. So you are the perfect person to be doing this. And a paper that caught my attention a while ago is called Religious Accommodations and the Common Good. And it's a very timely piece for setting the historical table for many of today's public policy debates and court decisions, as you just said. Whatever led you to take up this topic, religious accommodations and the common good?
That paper has an interesting genesis. I was actually asked to be an expert witness in the Baronelle Stutzman case. As you know, Baronelle Stutzman is a florist in Washington State. After Washington legalized same-sex marriage, she was asked by a couple that she had served for years, multiple years, $4,500 worth of business. She knew this was a same-sex couple, but she was happy to serve them. So she's not a bigot about these sorts of things. But when this couple asked her to do the flowers for their same-sex wedding ceremony, she went home and thought about it and prayed about it and decided that her religious convictions simply did not allow her to participate in the ceremony. And so she refused to do so, and the Attorney General of the state, ACLU, and the state came after her, came down on her like a ton of bricks, and that case is still being litigated. I was asked by her defense attorneys, people working for Alliance Defending Freedom, to come in as an expert witness. And what I wanted to argue was that America has a long tradition of protecting conscience, of protecting religious liberty in cases like this. Oftentimes, when opponents talk about a case like this, they say, wait a minute, we can't make any exception to this Washington law prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. If we make any exception, then the roof will fall in, the sky will fall, all sorts of evils will come about. And so part of what I wanted to argue historically is, no, we make exceptions to generally applicable statutes all the time to protect religious liberty, and the sky doesn't fall. America is still able to do things at the state and the federal level to promote the common good, even as we protect religious liberty.
And so you were an expert on that case, and I know that involves giving a lot of depositions, driving up to Washington State here, appearing on the stand, all that kind of stuff. But how did it ever make it into paper form? Did somebody approach you afterwards and say, hey, you need to write a paper? Or did you think, hey, so much fodder here and preparing for this case, I should get a line on my curriculum vitae?
Yeah, well, you know, fortunately the ACLU and the Attorney General were kind enough to come down to Oregon for my deposition, so I didn't actually have to go up there. And then the case, amazingly, never went to trial. The judge decided it upon a preliminary matter. I did write up my brief, though, and so it is in the official court record. So it was written back as the case was being litigated. It still is being litigated. It's still being appealed. But after I had written this up, I kind of liked it, and the Alliance Defending Freedom attorneys were good with me doing this, so I thought, well, I should make this more generally available. So I contacted some people I knew at the Heritage Foundation and suggested that I revise this into an essay that might be of use to advocates of religious liberty and hopefully convince people that religious liberty can be protected even as states and the nation pursue statutes that hopefully promote the common good. And so eventually, the Heritage Foundation published it, and I believe people should be able to find a link to that on your website.
Yeah, we will go ahead and link to that essay so people can read it, and we're going to talk about it more today. And I noticed that you said, fortunately, you didn't have to come up to Washington. What's wrong with my state here?
Oh, the state's fine. I just don't like to travel so much, so it's kind of nice to have everyone travel down here today.
Typical Oregonian. Okay, I get that. I get that. Well, we're going to not dig into too much of the normative implications of this today. We want to stick with the historical stuff because what your paper does is reveal a long history of accommodations, religious accommodations that have occurred for the past 200 years or so in a number of different areas that people might find surprising or may have forgotten. But I want to first start with the title of your paper, Religious Accommodation and the Common Good. That term, common good, What does that mean? How would I know the common good if I was walking down the street and it came up to me unannounced?
The common good is indeed a squishy sort of term, I admit it. Generally, I think we can agree, most American citizens can agree at a very broad and high level that the state or the national government should promote and provide certain goods. National defense, for instance, that the national government should protect America from invasion. Education. Almost all of us would say we want an educated citizenry, and the state has some sort of role to play in promoting education. Health. Who's against health, right? And so promoting public health is something that's in the common good. I think, again, anyone can be a sophomore and say, I'm against these sort of things. Can be sophomoric and say, I don't like education. But most people you talk to, from plumbers to professors to pastors, would say, yeah, we want an educated citizenry. Now, of course, we're going to argue and quibble about the means. But in general, what I mean by this is, I use it in the paper, almost all the laws I'm looking at are laws that are intended to promote the common good, something that most people would say, yeah, that's a good thing. We should have it. It would be a shame if we got rid of the statute and the nation was no longer able to defend itself, for instance.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting in the context of religious accommodation. So, yeah, okay, national security, I can give you that. I'll give you education. I might quibble about the way that it's provided. Healthcare, same thing. We all want that. Those are broad terms, and we'll have differences on the actual details of the policy. But when it comes to religious accommodations, is there anything that connects religion in the common good? Are we thinking here that, well, having a vibrant civil society with lots of churches on every street corner, is that part of the common good? Is that what we're thinking about here?
Yeah, well, and of course, our understanding of the common good has shifted over time. So if we went back to the 18th century, almost everyone would say Christianity is critical for the common good, and so the state ought to be involved in promoting Christianity, encouraging Christianity, because it benefits everyone. The way I think it plays out in my paper is this. You know, ever since late 18th century, pretty much there's been a profound consensus in America that the state ought not to tell people how to worship God or even if they should worship God. So almost everyone agrees at the sort of base level of religious liberty. The conflicts come when there's a statute aimed at promoting the common good. For instance, we as a society conclude that narcotics are bad and they ought to be illegal. They ought to be banned. I know some people disagree with that, but, you know, huge majorities would say, yes, narcotics ought to be banned. So we can all say, okay, these bans on narcotics promote the common good. What about the Native American who wants to use peyote, which is a banned narcotic, as part of a religious ceremony? And there's no question that this really is a religious ceremony. It's not someone just looking for an excuse to use drugs. What should be done in this sort of situation? There's, you know, really three major choices, I think. To begin with, you could say, let's throw out the laws against narcotics so the Native American can worship God according to the dictates of his conscience. So everyone can use narcotics. That would be one possible solution to this problem. And yet, if bans on narcotics really do promote the common good, we'd be losing something important if we took that approach. On the other hand, and many, many countries would do this, we could just say to the Native American, you're out of luck. We have a law. It's not against you, but it's promoting the common good, and so you're just out of luck. If you use peyote, we'll throw you in jail or fire you from your job or that sort of thing. So those are the two approaches that one could take. What I argue in my paper is that Americans, at their best, have said this. They've said, look, laws banning narcotics promote the common good, and we want to keep them in place, but we don't want to burden this Native American who has a sincere religious conviction that he or she ought to use peyote as part of a religious ceremony. Therefore, what we'll do is accommodate the Native American. We will create an exemption or exception for this Native American and permit him or her to use narcotics. Not in general, not to use any narcotic under the sun, anytime, any place, but we will create an exemption that allows this person to use peyote as part of a religious ceremony. And so that would be an accommodation. We continue to keep the laws promoting the common law, the common good, on the books, and yet we also protect the religious liberty of the Native American in this case. And that's just one example of the many examples I give within my paper.
Yeah, and you helped to clear up that next definition I was going to ask you about, which is what is a religious accommodation, because I thought that was a Catholic monastery setting up a bed and breakfast. But accommodation is a exemption from a typical policy, law, or regulation that applies to a broad base of the population, but exempts a certain class of individuals.
Right, exactly right. In this case, and there's all sorts of accommodations and exemptions on the books, but I'm particularly interested in where state legislatures or the national legislature or courts in some instances have created an exemption to protect religious convictions, and particularly actions of, based upon religious convictions.
And that issue has really become a hot-button topic today. We can think of cases that recently made it up to the Supreme Court, say involving Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Woods, as well as the Little Sisters of the Poor, when they were seeking accommodations from the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, or sometimes known as Obamacare. There's also been some lesser-known ones, I believe, in the past few years or past few months, actually. Sikhs have been allowed to wear turbans in the military, and Muslims have been allowed to keep their beards in some cases in prison and other places that have forbidden them. There's been other things, too. Religious schools deciding to fire individuals, the Hosanna Tabor case that we talked about on our podcast a few years ago. And then, as you mentioned, this court case that you were involved in, the bakeries and florists refusing to provide services for same-sex weddings. So this stuff is here with us. It's very present. Has it always been that way in American history? Have religious accommodations been so contentious?
Yes, there have always been religious accommodations. I would say, in many respects, America has grown to embrace a much more robust conception of religious liberty. So if you go back to the earliest, say, Puritan settlement, they weren't particularly accommodating of dissenters. I think by the late 18th century, you have a pretty profound consensus that religious liberty has to be protected, and oftentimes legislatures would create accommodations to protect Quakers, for instance, numerous sort of policy issues. Of course, one very important thing to keep in mind is that the role of government, well into the 20th century, was nowhere near as pervasive as it is today. So when we get to the 20th century, we start seeing volumes and volumes of regulations and laws touching on all sorts of things that governments historically haven't been interested in. And as the government has become far more intrusive, the need to create and to craft accommodations has become all the more pressing. But again, Americans at their best, Democrats and Republicans alike, have seen the need to craft these accommodations. And so you can look at statute after statute, and these accommodations are crafted. The Supreme Court got in the business of crafting them in the early 1960s and continued in that business well into the early 90s. Yeah, so everyone's been involved in doing this. And again, I would say this is America at its best. It's only over the last maybe 10 years or so that religious accommodations or religious exemptions have been being subjected to a lot more criticism than they have in the past. I think there's still a decent amount of support. If you ask almost anyone on the left or the right or the center, should Native Americans who have a sincere religious conviction that they ought to use peyote in religious ceremonies, still, almost everyone would say yes in answer to that question. But when we bring the Bernal Stutzman case, should a florist be free not to participate in the same-sex wedding ceremony if doing so cuts against her religious convictions? There we see Americans split pretty heavily on one side or the other, half saying yes, half saying no.
Yeah, this is interesting. It's a theme that has come up several times in different podcasts that we've had here on the show, that there's been a qualitative change in the way church and state has interacted with one another. Oh, since I'd say about the mid part of the 20th century, maybe the 1940s into the 50s or so. Prior to that, you know, America was largely seen as a Protestant nation. There was Catholic immigration coming in during that period of time, but a lot of church-state issues weren't all that contentious. But again, beginning in the middle part of the 20th century, you do see more and more court cases really kind of tinkering with and reconceptualizing what it means to have, or what the First Amendment really means, those two different clauses, free exercise as well as the non-establishment clause.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And it's particularly true in the establishment clause side of things. After Everson versus Board of Education, the national government got involved in regulating the relations between church and state at the state level in a way they never had before. Of course, you know, states took all sorts of different approaches, from very accommodationist sort of approaches to very separationist approaches. So one of the main things that changed in 1947 is now the U.S. Supreme Court comes and says, we're going to have a national standard. I'm not concerned in my paper about the Establishment Clause, although I'm very interested in it. I'm particularly concerned about the Religious Liberty Clause. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That latter clause, of course, is the free exercise clause. The court in the early 60s particularly started adopting a very robust understanding of that clause, saying that this clause actually requires accommodations unless the state can provide a very compelling reason why something can't be accommodated. And I should state clearly and up front that I don't think every action done in the name of religion should be accommodated. The state can justly say that certain things will not be permitted, period, even if they're motivated by religious conviction. But in the 1960s, under the leadership of William Brennan, one of the most liberal justices we've ever had, the Supreme Court started holding states to a very high standard, requiring religious accommodation. That, of course, went away in 1990 with the case of Oregon versus Smith. And it went away only for a couple of years because Congress responded almost unanimously saying we like the old standard. And in the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1993, the House unanimously approved, the Senate approved 97-3, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was signed into law by President Bill Clinton, requiring this high level of standard, requiring religious accommodation to be crafted and created unless the state could show a compelling reason why religious conviction should not be accommodated.
Yeah, and that Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that was eventually overturned at the Supreme Court level, correct?
The application of it to laws coming out of the states was deemed to be unconstitutional. It still applies to federal laws.
I see.
The Hobby Lobby case, for instance, was decided under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. We were exactly right with respect to the state that was declared outside of Congress's power to pass such a law. In response to that, though, something like 21 states passed their own state Religious Freedom Restoration Act aimed at creating the same sort of standard. And then many state constitutions, and Washington State, for example, continue to this very day to hold their state constitutions as adhering to this old standard adopted by the Supreme Court in the 1960s, requiring the state to show compelling interest in not accommodating something. So a good number of states still have this very robust understanding of religious liberty. Judges sometimes ignore it, but it's there in many, many states.
And it's interesting how we noted earlier that a number of these issues have become hot-button points of debate. And I know Indiana recently implemented a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, as well as I think it was North Carolina or South Carolina.
Arkansas, debated, and there's been firestorms in each case, which, again, I would suggest just suggest how much things have changed. They've become highly partisan, highly charged pieces of legislation. Oftentimes, the arguments are just horrible arguments, you know, made up of crazy hypotheticals that would that simply aren't problems, right? But when we hear them, we say, oh my goodness, that sounds horrible. We can't allow for that. That's why I think history is a really useful guide to see, okay, how have these things been implemented over time? If we make an accommodation to protect, say, a Quaker who believes he shouldn't take an oath or who can't fight in the military, does that mean that the sky will fall and we won't be able to defend ourselves or the courts of justice will become inoperable? And what you can see looking at history is, no, we've accommodated religious citizens time and time again, and we've done so very successfully. We've still been able to promote the common good at both the state and national levels.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me in your paper was this little figure that you gave about how many laws there are being accommodated. Some over 2,000 laws as of the, I think, the middle 1990s or so that give religious some kind of religious accommodation. That's amazing. Have there increased since that time? Are there more than 2,000 now? Do you have any sense of that?
You know, I've started undertaking a project when I'm going through the state statutes and looking at issue after issue and counting these up for myself. So I haven't done the full, I haven't made it all the way through, obviously. It's a huge enterprise. I would imagine they've expanded. State legislatures in the deepest of the blue states or the deepest of the red states tend to be protective of religious liberty. And so they craft accommodations to protect religious citizens from against general mutually applicable laws. So yeah, there's quite a few. The 1990s statistic comes from a law review article that I cited. I'm not sure exactly what methodology that author used. So I can't vouch for it. You know, I just give the citation. But it strikes me it's probably right, and I would imagine there's actually more today.
Yeah, there is a lot. And I think you touched upon one of the reasons earlier when you said as the role of the federal as well as state governments have expanded to various parts of life, the more laws you have, the more accommodations you're going to need. Does religious pluralism factor into this expanding list of accommodations as well?
I think it absolutely does. You know, back when the Constitution was written, if you look at Americans of European descent, about 98% of them are Protestant, about 2% are Catholic, and you have about 1,000 Jews in America scattered in four or five cities. So it's a very Christian country, at least in terms of how people would identify themselves if they were asked. Today, something like only 75% of Americans identify themselves as Christians, and of course you have significant numbers of Buddhists and Muslims and Hindus and others, and oftentimes these sects will bring convictions that might not be shared by others. So, for instance, a number of states have laws on the books prohibiting prisoners from wearing beards for some pretty good reasons. You can hide contraband in beards. If you're a prisoner who has a beard and you escape, one of the things you could do to pretty easily disguise yourself is to shave your beard, right? And you look significantly different. And so prisoners, a number of states have regulations prohibiting prisoners from growing beards. For most people, that's not a problem. Most Christian prisoners can grow beards, or not have beards, rather, and that doesn't violate their religious conviction. But as I'm sure you know, a good Muslim will insist on having facial hair. A good Muslim believes that Islam teaches that he has to have some sort of facial hair. It doesn't have to be a full-fledged beard, but you know, mustache or something like that. And so we recently had a case coming out of Arkansas where the state of Arkansas said, no, we have a law in place, no exceptions to this law, even though there was an exception for medical necessity. But leaving that aside, this case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was decided on something called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. An act passed around 2000, again, I think, virtually unanimously. Democrats and Republicans alike said we need to require even prisons to respect the religious liberty of prisoners, the religious liberty, they weren't necessarily thinking this, but in this case it's applied, the religious liberty of this relatively small minority of prisoners that are Muslims, their needs need to be respected. And this case was decided, I believe, 9-0 in favor of the Muslim inmate, saying, look, state of Arkansas, you can have reasonable regulations on what sort of beard, but there's no reasonable security risk if you allow this person to grow a very short, say, quarter-inch beard, something like that. Yeah, and so that's just that's a long-winded way of answering your question. Yeah, now that we have Muslims and Sikhs and Hindus and Buddhists and all sorts of other citizens of different religions running around, you have a lot more religious liberty claims than you might have had were we all Christians.
Yeah, something you just said struck me, and this is kind of a tangent, but when you mentioned the Muslim beards in prison, and it's the reason we didn't have beards in prison, that always kind of struck me. It's like, well, why not? What's the big deal about beards? But yeah, now that you say, yeah, when you escape, you can shave it off and you look different. I never thought of that. See, I learned something every time I listen to you. And it's not always about religion. It's about escaping from prison.
Yeah, how about that?
How about that? One other thing that I've kind of hypothesized on, and this isn't in your article, but I just thought we'd, you know, throw this out there and see what you think, is another reason that we're seeing more of these religious accommodation cases and exemptions, because we're existing in a more litigious society than we have in the past century or so?
You know, I think that's right, and I think there are also a number of groups out there. You know, one of the high bars in the past would be you had a right to litigate something, but if you didn't have deep pockets, you couldn't afford to do so. Today, there are a lot of nonprofit groups, from the ACLU to the ADF to the Christian Legal Society to the Religious Liberty Institute, all sorts of groups on the right and left that are willing to litigate your cases. And religious liberty is one of those issues where they oftentimes come together. And the ACLU and a Christian legal organization will stand side by side with a Muslim inmate saying, look, this person should be given an accommodation. Yes, I think we are more litigious, and we have these legal organizations, nonprofit legal organizations, public interest law firms that are there to litigate the case. So even people who can't afford to pay for an attorney have good legal representation.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. There's all these different organizations, from the ADF to the ACLU, that they do create very interesting coalitions. And you mentioned Oregon v. Smith before. And if you go back in court history and look at all the people who participated on the side of Smith, the individual who was fired and was applying for unemployment benefits after taking peyote, it is one of the strangest coalitions that you might ever imagine.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. If you look at the sort of people that were supporting the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, it was left and right and center. Virtually everyone was on board. Now, I think if you look about 10 years after that, a number of the groups that on what we would think of, and left and right isn't always useful, but we would think of as being on the left, law professors and organizations like the ACLU, have had second thoughts about things such as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Primarily because they fear that such acts can be used to protect people who would want to discriminate, particularly on the basis of sexual orientation. So when the ACLU looks at a case such as the Flores case in Washington, they don't deny that Baronelle Stuthman is religious, that she's sincere about her religious views, but they just say religion is no excuse for discrimination. And so I think we have seen a bit of a sea change in this respect. Now, whether or not it really is discrimination, and that's a loaded term to begin with, we could argue about, but I'm just trying to describe some of the change that we've seen probably over the last 10 years or so.
Well, let's not just worry about the last 10 years. Let's dig deep back into history, because that is where you absolutely shine. You're very good on contemporary issues, but you're a historian par excellence. Even though you're a political scientist, you're a great political historian. Let's talk about some of the key areas throughout American history where religious accommodations have been historically salient, and then some of the new areas where we see it popping up. And some of these you might not necessarily think about because times have changed and we really haven't needed these accommodations in recent years. But let's go ahead and stick with the most basic exemption. You said that in terms of the common good, national security is one of those things that, you know, everybody tends to agree on. And when it comes to national security and providing for that, you need soldiers, and oftentimes there is required military service, conscription, or the draft, as they as has often been said. Tell us about religious accommodations and military service.
Yeah, I think that's a great example, because pretty much everyone would agree that national defense is a public good that we all should support. In some ways, it was even more important in the early colonies, where there was a significant fear that the European settlements could be wiped out by Native American attacks. And so pretty much every colony would require all able-bodied men to come and be in the militia, to serve in the militia, so they could be called up to fight off attacks. This practice continued well into the 18th century, so a lot of the troops that fought in the War for Independence were militia troops, for instance. And so, this seems reasonable, and it seems fair that everyone would be required to participate. There are always, of course, some exceptions. If you're unable to do so for physical reasons, well, that's fine. Everyone understands that. But the question arose, what about these Quaker pacifists and a few other denominations that were pacifists? They believe that Jesus really means what he says in Matthew 5, right? Love your enemy, turn the other cheek, and certainly this means I'm not going to shoot the person. I'm not going to kill someone. And so you have these, I'm just going to focus on the Quakers. I teach at George Fox University, a school founded by Quakers and still in the Quaker tradition. And so you have these Quakers saying, look, we simply cannot serve in the military. Well, in many, many states today, in many nations today, people who make that sort of claim are just put in jail or even executed. You know, a lot of governments would say, you serve or you die or you serve and go to prison. Very early on, even though Quakers were always a tiny minority pretty much everywhere, even in Pennsylvania, they were a minority. But what happened in these colonies is they said, okay, we don't want to require you to serve in violation of your religious convictions. Now, we still think you have an obligation to contribute to the national defense. And so if you pay a fine, if you pay a tax, if you hire a substitute, then you don't have to serve in a combat capacity. Some Americans, if I jump to the American founding, Americans like Roger Sherman and James Madison said even that's kind of unfair, requiring them to hire a substitute, because some Quaker pacifists would see that as equally violative of the religious conviction. So, you know, this goes way back into the early colonies, certainly well throughout the 19th century. The national government really didn't get in the business of having any sort of significant draft until the Selective Service Act of 1917. For World War I, we really had a significant need for manpower. And so the Selective Service Act was passed to require American males to register for the draft. Many were drafted, in fact. And yet, the Congress that passed this recognized, okay, we have these religious pacifists out there. We ought not to force them to serve against a religious conviction. What we will do, if you are a religious pacifist who's a member of a historic peace church, the Quakers, the Mennonites, the Amish, the Brethren, we will allow you to serve in a non-combat capacity as a medic or something like that. Now, if you aren't willing to do that, then you're out of luck. Then you, in fact, go to jail. And so some Americans were sent to jail. But there was this clear attempt to protect these religious Americans. I've gone back and read the Senate debates and the House debates over this. And again, there were significant concerns raised that such accommodations would hurt the common good. If we start exempting religious pacifists, then all of a sudden all these men who don't want to fight in the war will say, oh, I'm a Quaker pacifist, I can't fight. And yet, when you look at how this was actually implemented, very, very few Americans took exemption of this accommodation. Many Quakers, actually, who weren't Quaker pacifists, went and fought. In any case, and America was able to meet its manpower needs. In World War II, we actually broadened the accommodation to just religious pacifists. So now, if you were a Baptist who happened to be a religious pacifist, you didn't have to fight either. And again, in spite of the tens of millions of men that we needed to fight in that war, we were able to accommodate these religious pacifists and still raise the sort of manpower we needed to win this war. And it's hard to think about an issue of national importance that rises to the level of defending ourselves in World War I, and particularly World War II, right? Our very existence as a nation is at stake, and yet Congress in both of these instances still saw religious liberty as something so important that it had to be protected, and it was successfully protected without hurting our ability to win these wars.
Yeah, the issue becomes salient again during the Vietnam era. There was a lot of people who were not on board with what the U.S. was doing in Vietnam. And I think you saw an uptick of people wanting to have conscientious objection recognized to some extent.
No, I think that's right. Although the standard remained the same, even though there's some sort of goofy Supreme Court cases that we probably shouldn't talk about because they might just complicate the issue. If we look at the congressional statutes, Congress said, look, religious pacifists don't have to engage in military service. Everyone else does. If you're drafted and you simply think the war in Vietnam is bad policy, too bad for you. You still have to fight. Interestingly enough, I'm not a pacifist. I'm a just war theorist. I believe some wars are just, some wars are unjust. Assuming for the sake of argument that I thought the war in Vietnam was an unjust war, and I thought so for religious reasons, I wouldn't be accommodated. It's only religious pacifists who were accommodated. And so Congress has decided to protect some categories of religious belief, but it decided, I think imprudently, but nonetheless it decided, and the U.S. Supreme Court upheld its rights inside this, that it wouldn't accommodate some religious convictions, that is, a selective conscientious objector. We could argue about that. I think we could pretty safely accommodate just war theorists like myself, and I'm not arguing that out of self-interest. I'm beyond the draft age at this point. But I think you could protect such Americans and still meet their manpower needs. In Vietnam, we were far from full mobilization, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to emphasize, people who are accommodated are not let off scot-free. They have to serve their country in other ways. If you go back to World War I, it was in a non-combat capacity. When we get to Vietnam, you could do your service in an inner city or something like that. So we aren't talking about a way of dodging duty. It's just a matter of how you execute your duty. And I think Congress, at its best, says we aren't going to force people to violate the religious conviction if we can reasonably accommodate them, if we can allow them to do something else that still is costly and that still benefits the country.
Now, this brings up an issue, and I want to just step aside before we pick up some of these other issues, because I do think it will be relevant, is how do you know that the person is being sincere? This was a concern, as you mentioned, back in 1917, when a number of senators or congressional representatives said, whoa, if we allow these exemptions here, everybody is going to have a Quaker conversion next week, and we won't have anybody to fight our war. How do you know that that's sincere or not? And how, with many of these other convictions, say, for instance, for peyote, maybe I can say, well, I just converted to Native American religion and I want to go get some peyote now. How do we deal with that? What kind of mechanisms do we have to make sure that these convictions are really sincere?
Yeah, that is a tricky issue. And I think it's fair to say there's no such thing as a perfect public policy. I think, fortunately, courts have said we have no business determining the truth or falsehood of beliefs or the true or false interpretation of the Bible. So I, as a Christian, can look at the Bible and say, I don't think the Bible requires Christians to be pacifists. My Quaker friends come to a different conclusion, and very appropriately, courts aren't going to step into the middle and say, well, Mark is right and the Quaker's wrong. So I think that's wise to keep the courts out of these sorts of areas. Sometimes to get at sincerity, the court or the Congress will try to narrow the range of who can be protected by these accommodations. That's why I think Congress in 1917 said, well, you have to show that you're a member of a historic peace church, a Quaker, Mennonite, Amish. So if you can show that you grew up in the Quaker church and this sort of thing, and that you're a Quaker pacifist, you know, there's a good reason to believe this. On the other hand, if you're someone who's just gone on throughout his life as someone who's not religious, and then as soon as he's drafted decides to join a Quaker church and claim to be a Quaker pacifist, we might have the ability to know that this person is not being sincere. So that's the sort of fear that led Congress to that sort of accommodation in 1917. Congress, as I said, did open the door a lot more broadly. And when we look at that in World War II, you still see a precious few Americans that took advantage of this accommodation. And I think it's fair to say some who did probably weren't sincere. Courts, I think, wisely have generally stayed out of the business of judging sincerity. If you say that you have a sincere conviction, they will generally take your word for it. I'm sure some fraud has been done, has been perpetrated because of that. But I would say whatever fraud has been perpetrated is more than outweighed by the benefit of protecting the what we know are the sincere convictions of many, many Americans who have been protected by such accommodations.
Yeah. Now, the issue of conscientious objection has largely disappeared off the radar. We still have selective service registration. I believe there is still a conscientious objection box that you can check and not have to register, if I am correct. Is that true still?
That is correct.
Yeah. But here's the interesting thing. Ever since we got rid of the draft in the early 1970s, I think it was 71 or 72, maybe 73, other issues related to the military have come up in somewhat the opposite direction, that there are people who want to serve but couldn't serve because of their religious rituals that now are pressing their cases too.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. A famous case came about in the 1980s where you had a Air Force psychologist stationed in the middle of Ohio or something like that. And this person was an Orthodox Jew, and he was perfectly happy to meet all the military standards of dress, and yet he wanted to wear a yarmulke, the head covering, the skull cap. And the U.S. military said, no, 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 you can't have this. This would violate military policy. This case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court, very disappointingly, said, well, we're just going to defer to the military. The military knows better than we do. I think it was a 6-3 decision, so some justices didn't agree. And yet here is one of those areas where I think Congress, steps up for the American people. And so Congress almost right away passed laws requiring the military to make reasonable accommodations to allow this Jewish psychologist stationed in the middle of Ohio to wear a skull cap, for instance. This has been applied to Sikhs that have to have beards and turbans and carry a ceremonial knife. It's been applied to all sorts of religious Americans, which, again, I think there's been no evidence that these sorts of accommodations have hurt morale or have hurt combat readiness. And, in fact, it's permitted Americans who we probably want to serve so that they, if we're dealing with these populations overseas, they can see we aren't just a bunch of white, clean-shaven males, but we represent the plurality of America. And so Congress has stepped in and required the military to make these accommodations. The military generally has done so, sometimes kicking and screaming, but I think there's very little evidence that it's hurt military preparedness.
Yeah, we had a podcast about a year ago with a member of the Sikh Coalition, and they were talking about this military issue that Sikhs who have to have long beards would have a problem fitting in gas masks. And so there's some practical concerns here too. And do you keep the beard? Do you not keep the beard? Do you keep your hair up? Do you not keep your hair up? What do you do? But it was decided that there would be a religious accommodation made. And as a result, they created new gas masks for individuals, which was kind of interesting. And we will link back to that podcast so people can check that out when I'm on vacation here. Here's another interesting one that I hadn't thought about for a long time, but I guess it's still kind of percolating out there. It's the issue of religious accommodations for swearing oaths. And, you know, I thought swearing was a bad thing and sign of a limited vocabulary. So what's all this stuff about swearing?
Yeah, I've been working on that with you. your wife and I have been trying to get you to cut down on swearing. But this is a different sort of swearing.
Oh, okay.
It's taking of an oath. And this particularly, the importance of this rises significantly if you go back to the context of the 18th century, where an oath is not just a promise. We all know a promise, I make a promise to meet you somewhere for coffee, and I should keep it. An oath is a promise before God, with God as a witness. And so we take oaths not just in your routine activities of life, but when you're becoming a U.S. citizen, for instance, you take an oath of allegiance. When you become a congressperson or state legislature, you take an oath of office. When you join the military, you take an oath. When you are testifying in a court, you take an oath. And the idea here is this is a really important promise with God as a witness. Let me just read you a quick quote from George Washington in his famous farewell address that I think helps put a pin on this. He writes, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indisputable supports. A volume could not trace all their connections with private and public felicity. Let it simply be asked, where is the security for property, for reputation, for life, if the sense of religious obligation desert the oaths, which are the instruments of investigation of the courts of justice?" And what I really want to emphasize there is that last line or so. Basically, Washington is saying that we can't imagine the justice system working if we didn't have these oaths, these sacred oaths, these sacred promises to tell the truth with God as a witness. So for all sorts of reasons that I mentioned already, these are critical for the functioning of our society. Well, fine, almost all Americans would have agreed with this in the 18th century. But again, my Quaker friends are a problem. The Quakers take Jesus seriously, where he says in Matthew, "Let their yes, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Don't take oaths. I'm paraphrasing there, but basically that's what he said. The Quaker said Jesus meant what he said. We shouldn't take oaths. Now, this is a problem. The Quakers got in a lot of trouble in England because they refused to take oaths of allegiance to the crown. They were thrown in jail, and they couldn't litigate their cases, or at least serve as witnesses in their own cases, because they couldn't take oaths and thus testify at trial. They ran into some problems with this in America as well. But even back then, people recognized, hey, these Quakers are pretty good folks. They're law-abiding citizens. They're folks we want around. We want to encourage them to be here. And so almost, not right away, but by the late 1690s, certainly in the early 18th century, the colonies and then the early nation, Continental Congress supported this, said we need to accommodate our Quaker friends. Now, Quakers make a distinction that I'm not prepared to defend. They said, look, we don't take oaths, but we don't mind affirming them. All right? So we will affirm that our testimony is true. We will affirm that we will serve faithfully in a public office and this sort of thing. And so what happened is a lot of states started permitting Quakers and others who have religious reasons for doing so to offer an oath or affirmation. You find these throughout all the statute books in 18th century America. Notably, and I think this is important, I'm glad you brought up oaths, the U.S. Constitution itself has a religious accommodation. In three different provisions, people are permitted to take an oath or to affirm, right? Most famously, perhaps, a presidential oath of office. We call it an oath of office. But a Quaker, or really anyone, but it clearly was put in place to protect religious convictions, can affirm the oath of office, the presidential oath of office, and that is legally binding. We've had two Quakers become president. Both of them have been willing to take the oath of office. One president, Franklin Pierce, I believe it was, didn't want to take the oath, and so he affirmed this oath of office. Not for religious reasons, as I understand it, but that option was out there. And it's available because the authors of the U.S. Constitution wanted Quakers and others to be able to serve as president and otherwise participate in our constitutional form of government.
Now, this issue has somewhat disappeared off the radar, too, or, you know, everybody agrees, okay, if you're a Quaker, you don't have to take oath, everything is fine. If you're a Muslim congressional representative, you don't want to swear on the Bible, that's fine, you can bring in the Quran, all well and good, right? But does this issue at all resonate in the opposite direction for atheists, that a lot of times before municipal council meetings, they'll say the Pledge of Allegiance and say under God, and the atheists say, well, I don't want to say under God, or they might be upset that there's a prayer right before the religious meeting. Does this accommodation work in kind of a mirror reversed image here that benefits atheists?
Yeah, I would say, and one of the things I've looked at as I've spent time in statute books is oftentimes today in our state codes where they have oath requirements, it provides for an oath or affirmation, oftentimes still including the word, so help me God, but then oftentimes there's alternatives, like I promise on the basis of my conscience to tell the truth, something of that nature, clearly I think aimed at accommodating atheists. Now, what you raised with respect to prayers before city council meetings or saying the Pledge of Allegiance, that's more of an establishment clause issue, I think. And the courts have generally held that these things are permissible. And basically the sort of logic is you don't have a right to not be accosted by speech that you don't like. You can't be forced to say a prayer. You can't be forced to join in a prayer. You can't be forced to say the Pledge of Allegiance with the word, so help me God, in it. So we're not going to force the atheist to do any of these things, but the atheist doesn't have a right not to hear them, basically, is the way courts have approached it.
Yeah. Here's another issue that you brought up, and this one I hadn't known about. Maybe I did a little bit in the background, but this is one of these other forgotten accommodations, right? You know, nowadays in the news, we focus on accommodations that are the hot button issues. But you know, as we've covered some of these swearing oaths and the military things that, yeah, we accommodate and it's no big deal. Here's another one, mandatory school attendance. Where does that one come up?
Yeah, no, that's great because, you know, who's against mandatory school attendance? And particularly nowadays, the statutes are written such that it's not requiring you to go to public school necessarily, right? It's just requiring that you receive more or less formal schooling between the ages, say, of 5 and 16. It could be in a public school, could be in a private school, could be homeschool, right? But almost everyone would say these are good laws. We don't want parents to have the freedom just to stop educating their children when they turn 7. Now, I just mentioned in today's context, it's pretty easy to start a private school or do homeschooling. Back in the 60s, it wasn't. It was actually oftentimes very onerous to create a private school, and homeschooling just wasn't all that well known. And yet states would have laws requiring mandatory school attendance. So our friends the Amish ran afoul of these laws, particularly in the state of Wisconsin. And the Amish, in this case, in a town New Glarus, I believe it was, they didn't object to sending their kids to the local elementary school. They wanted the kids to learn to read and write. And yet they objected to sending the child off to middle school, or their children off to middle school. They thought they would become corrupted by these worldly ways. They would learn worldly things about rock and roll music and who knows what else. And it's a direct violation of the religious convictions to continue to allow their children to be in public schools. And again, back in this area, it wasn't simply an option for them to pull their kids out and homeschool them or to put them in a private school. So this case was litigated up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court pretty much unanimously, I think you could say it was 8.5 to 1.5, Justice Douglas issued kind of a mixed opinion. The Supreme Court said this. The court said, look, there are lots of good reasons for having mandatory attendance laws. But the question with respect to these Amish, do we have a compelling reason to force these Amish citizens to go against a religious conviction and send their kids to public school? We have lots of reasons, even lots of good reasons, but the standard is compelling reason. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, there isn't. We have to give these Amish a judicially created accommodation. We'll let them take their children out of public schools and continue to train them in their own way of life. We have to respect their religious convictions. The state simply doesn't have the sort of, it doesn't meet the very high bar that would be necessary to force these Amish to go against their religious convictions. So yeah, it's a critical case, one of the most outstanding cases of the U.S. Supreme Court protecting religious liberty that one could point to.
Yeah, that was the famous Wisconsin v. Yoder, and that did occur in New Glarus, and I have a little connection to that because growing up during that period of time, there was a bike trail that I always went on in New Glarus, Wisconsin. So it's not only famous for that bike trail, but for a Supreme Court case.
All right.
Which is really interesting. Yeah, so here we've been dealing with these issues of military draft, of swearing oaths, of mandatory school attendance. All of these things seem to be issues that, are, you know, you talk to anybody on the street, they just go, eh, okay. And it doesn't seem that contentious. Everything's cool. As you say, you know, this is America's at its best, just saying, yeah, you got different views than mine. We're going to accommodate those. What about some of the other areas that have been a little bit more contentious that have cropped up recently? I know some of these involve vaccinations. That's a big issue as of recently, and the alcohol and drug use. We covered Oregon v. Smith, but cover some of the other general areas. Again, there's 2,000 plus laws that are exempted here, create religious accommodations, but what are some of these other areas that fall under the category of religious exemptions?
Yeah, sure. We mentioned vaccinations. Right now, all 50 states require vaccinations, that children be vaccinated in order to attend school. And it doesn't matter what kind of school, private school, public school. 47 states give an accommodation to parents who have a religious conviction against receiving medical treatment of that nature. Christian Scientists jump to mind, but there's others that have this as well. Again, I think we can all agree, and I know there's some debate about medical science, but I think it's fair to say Americans overwhelmingly want to live in a healthy society. There's a lot of good reason to believe that these vaccinations tamp down and in some cases virtually exterminate horrible diseases that are infectious. And so they're a very good thing. So the question becomes, can we accommodate those few Americans that have religious objections to vaccinations? There's, of course, accommodations for medical reasons as well. Those are pretty much non-controversial. About 17 states, maybe 16 states now, have accommodations for reasons of conscience. So these states have decided to protect those atheists that we were talking about earlier, who simply have principled objections to vaccination, but they aren't religious. But 47 states do, in fact, exempt religious citizens from these accommodations. Let me mention that, as I've suggested before, and I do want to emphasize, I am not arguing that all religious beliefs should be accommodated. If medical science shows that granting too many accommodations for religious reasons could undermine the very purpose of vaccinations and could lead to outbreaks of infectious diseases, states might have to remove these accommodations or limit them. California did this recently. When I wrote this piece, I think it was 48 states had religious accommodations to the vaccination requirement. California saw the outbreak of measles in a couple of places. There are pockets of California where large numbers of Californians were taking advantage of this accommodation. Probably people who didn't all have religious objections to it. They were just engaged in this fraud that we talked about earlier. They had maybe objections based on medical science, so they claimed a religious objection. So you were getting areas of California that you had upwards of maybe 30% of the children weren't being vaccinated. And so California determined we cannot continue to grant this accommodation. I think California probably could have narrowed the accommodation to protect those Americans who really did have religious objections, those Californians that really did have religious objections. But it certainly is the right of the state to look at and say, can we continue to afford this accommodation? And I think it's telling, when you look at these other 47 states, what medical science shows us is it actually is okay to have a small percentage of people in these states not being vaccinated, as long as the vast majority are vaccinated. Those few citizens that aren't vaccinated don't really pose a threat to public health. So this is kind of a classic example where if we just stipulate for the sake of argument that requiring vaccinations does promote the public health, the common good in other words, that we can't do that and accommodate those few Americans that have religious objections to such vaccinations, and basically everyone wins in the end. Those Americans with religious convictions in these areas, but also the state is healthier.
Yeah, this is one of those really interesting cases where you do have science telling you that, well, for various diseases, there's a herd immunity of, you know, 80%, 85, maybe 90% of the population, leaving 10 to 20% unvaccinated is not a big deal. It's not going to create a huge outbreak. But once you start to push that boundary, once you start to get to 10, 15, 20% not vaccinating, as happened in California in a few pockets there, yeah, it's time to revisit those laws, I guess. It's a really nice case study for these accommodations.
Exactly. Tony, can I mention one more accommodation that I think is particularly relevant to some of these cases that we're seeing today? And it's one that will be unfamiliar to most of your listeners. Back as America entered World War II, a lot of states said, you know what, we're going to war. We have to be unified. We have to be patriotic. And so a number of states passed laws requiring public school children to salute the American flag and to say the Pledge of Allegiance, right? This is going to promote patriotism. There are small numbers of Americans who see this as no different than idol worship, no different than a Christian or a Muslim or a Buddhist being told to bow down and worship Baal. That's how they see the Pledge of Allegiance. These primarily Jehovah's Witnesses said, we simply cannot do this. We simply cannot pledge allegiance to the American flag and salute it. We're patriotic, but we can't do that. This case went to the Supreme Court, interestingly, in 1940, and the Supreme Court said, you know what? National unity is so important that we're just going to override. We're just going to run over these Jehovah's Witness kids, kick them out of school, fine their parents, because national unity is so important. 3 years later, fortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, what are we thinking? We are not going to, states cannot compel these children to engage in what they see as a religious act against their conviction. One reason I want to emphasize this is most people, I certainly don't, I'm guessing you don't, see pledging allegiance to the American flag, saluting the flag, we don't see that as a religious act. These Jehovah's Witness kids do. And let me point out that I think religious liberty has to protect people like that. It's not a question of whether or not the Jehovah's Witness kids are right or wrong. It's not a question of whether or not we understand or agree with the religious conviction. The fact is they have a religious conviction that says saluting the American flag is a violation of my sincerely held religious convictions. that conviction ought to be respected unless the state has a compelling interest in not respecting it. And I think we can all agree that the state didn't have a compelling interest in this case. I mention this because when you look at the case of, say, a Baronel Stutzman, she says that she has a religious conviction against participating in a same-sex wedding ceremony. Most of us might look at that and say, I don't get it. If I was a florist, I would take whatever business came before me. If I was a baker, I would take whatever business comes before me. The fact that you and I might not get it just is irrelevant from my perspective. If a Baronel Stutzman says she has a religious conviction against participating in such a ceremony, that conviction ought to be respected unless the state has a compelling interest in not respecting it. So I think the analogy is perhaps useful for helping us to think about how we should think about religious liberty. It's not our religious convictions or true religious convictions. We ought to go out of the way to protect whatever is claimed as a religious conviction, unless, again, the state has a compelling interest not to respect it.
So you touched upon one of those other issues that's cropped up recently with the Washington State Florist and dealing with civil rights issues. And those still are kind of percolating out there. And we're not going to dive into those very much right here, but we'll let people kind of reflect upon what is happening in our contemporary times with what you told us has been going on historically. But I do want to finish off with this question, and that is, where are we headed with these issues of religious accommodation over the next few decades? It seems that throughout American history, we've given broad birth to a number of people who have serious religious convictions and that run counter to a variety of laws. The military service, the oath thing, those things seem to be non-controversial, cleared themselves up over time. Not that big a deal, but always new issues arising. So where do you see all this heading?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I'll make two different distinctions that I think are important. One is that in a number of the cases we've talked about, the religious conviction just involves a person. It doesn't involve a person wanting to do something that's perceived as harming someone else. And so this might allow us to distinguish between the Native American peyote user, who, if that person is allowed to use peyote, you know, maybe hurts himself, assuming peyote is a negative drug, which I think it probably is, but he's not hurting anyone else, whereas arguably Baronel Stutzman is hurting someone else by refusing to participate in someone's wedding ceremony, by refusing to do this. So I think what are called third-party harms is an important distinction that might need to be considered. I think as well the sort of entity we're talking about is very, very relevant. So I think even to this date, there is a great consensus that clergy and houses of worship should have almost complete autonomy from the state. So even your most gung-ho gay rights activist is not advocating for the state requiring clergy to officiate at same-sex wedding ceremonies or requiring churches or synagogues or mosques to hold said ceremonies against their religious convictions. Now, of course, some clergy and some houses of worship are perfectly happy hosting these sorts of ceremonies and officiating at them, and they're free to do so. But almost no one's saying clergy and houses of worship should be forced to do this. And I think we're pretty safe there with respect to religious liberty. Far more questionable are religious nonprofits, Christian colleges or other religious colleges, places like George Fox University, Seattle Pacific, Calvin College. To what extent should they be free to say we want faculty to have traditional Christian views of marriage or not to be in same-sex partnerships or that sort of thing? That right now is where a whole lot of the debate is taking place, and it's unclear where this will come out. I think there's some pretty important precedents and pretty good reasons to believe that religious institutions, religious charities, religious hospitals ought to be free to act according to their religious convictions, but that's where the battleground is. And then I think private for-profit businesses, bakery, a florist, a photographer. Right now, these have been faring very, very poorly within in the court system. And so, again, some of these cases are still being litigated. We don't know how they'll come out. But generally, the public seems, I think, a little bit too comfortable with the idea that no one has a right to be a baker or florist. If you open a bakery or a flower shop, you have to serve all comers. You can't refuse to serve anyone. It's kind of absurd if you think about it. You can come up with all sorts of scenarios, you know, real easily, right? An African-American baker who's asked to bake a cake for the KKK that has offensive, you know, language about African-Americans. Almost no one would say that African-Americans should be forced to do this. So no one really believes in an all-comers policy. But right now, private businesses are, and individuals acting in a for-profit capacity are receiving almost no protection with respect to religious liberty claims. And I think that's too bad. Hopefully it will change, and yet that's where we are today.
Well, a lot of things to think about, not only in terms of contemporary issues, but historical issues as well. And Mark David Hall, our guest today, always does a great job in filling us in on those historical debates. Mark, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Hey, thank you very much for having me, Tony. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.